We can't keep the secret any longer. The Entrepreneurista League is here. Over the past year, we've been hard at work building something extra special for our Entrepreneurista community. You told us what you wanted: exclusive game-changing business-boosting content, members-only events to network and connect, the opportunity to have your story and business featured on Entrepreneurista.com, the chance to promote your business to our audience on the Entrepreneurista social channels. Your wish has been granted. Introducing the Entrepreneurista League. When you join the Entrepreneurista League, you will get access to our private community of entrepreneuristas who are making an impact in business every single day. Whether you're looking to scale your business, meet potential investors, make exciting business building connections, or finally take the leap to launch your business and share the candid reality of building a business from the ground up, we are here to give you access to a community of women who will celebrate and support you every step of the way. Applications are open, so head over to entrepreneurista.com/join for a special offer. That's entrepreneurista.com/join. We can't wait to welcome you, support you, and be the best part of your business growth.
That mission stayed at the forefront, but became much easier because we had been surrounding ourselves by people that didn't look like us for so many years. And so now that deal flow just comes naturally, which is really cool. I know a lot of funds have to work really hard to put diversity at the forefront of their deal flow, but for us, it's just naturally there.
When Jamie Schmidt found out she was pregnant, she began paying more attention to the products she was putting on her skin and started making her own body care products to sell at markets and festivals. As her customer base grew and retailers began to approach her, Schmidt's Naturals was on its way to becoming a household name. You're about to hear how Jamie approached her venture one day at a time and what she's learned in transitioning from a solo founder to selling her business to Unilever. Coming up, how Schmidt's Naturals has challenged the stigma around natural products and who they're really made for. Why Jamie says going to market without a perfect product is totally okay. Her lessons learned in understanding the supply sourcing and wholesale processes. How to navigate the flexibility and quickness of a startup. And finally, Jamie shares her experience in starting to offer financial support to underrepresented entrepreneurs with her fund, Color Capital. This is the Entrepreneurista Podcast, presented by Socialfly.
It's the best business meeting you'll ever have, with must-hear real-life looks at how leading women in business are getting it done.
And what it takes to build and grow a successful company.
It's beyond the gram.
With no filters,
no limits,
and plenty of surprises. Jamie, we are so excited to sit down with you today and hear all about your incredible Entrepreneurista journey, because you have had an incredible ride over the years, launching your first startup and now being an investor and involved in many different companies. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
Of course. I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
I would love to hear about how you started your first company. I know you started it in your kitchen over 10 years ago, but did you have a background in beauty or in chemistry? How did you start?
I did not. My company was Schmidt's Naturals, for those who don't know. We're most known for our deodorant. And when I started the business, it was more of a hobby. You know, I didn't come into this with a really concrete business plan, you know, struck with an idea that I thought would make me rich someday. There were a few things that led to it. I was pregnant at the time. So I was paying closer attention to the products I was using on my skin. Was also on a pretty strict budget. Yeah, I was working as a social worker, so was my husband. You know, we got pregnant unexpectedly and found ourselves in a position where we didn't have a whole lot of money. And so making things at home, you know, was one way to save. I also was living in Portland, you know, most creative city in the country. Everybody there is, you know, a maker, creator, artist of some sort. And it was kind of my way to fit in, was to start making personal care products. One day I took a class on how to make shampoo. With that, everything took off, right? I started making everything, my lotions, my sunscreens, my shampoos and scrubs and deodorant. And then in Portland, there's no shortage of opportunity to sell. And again, at this point, I didn't realize the business opportunity, but I did think it would be fun to get out and set up a table at the farmers markets and street festivals. And so my baby was now newly born. And I'd go out on the weekends and set up my booth. But in talking to customers, I started to understand there actually was a pretty big business opportunity. This was 2010. Natural products were not yet mainstream. There was still opportunity to innovate in the category, and especially in deodorant. We had a couple of brands at the time, and Tom's of Maine, Jason, but natural deodorants were still pretty new. So I recognized there was big opportunity for shelf placement, but also to do things a little bit differently, really to kind of challenge the stigma around naturals and who naturals are made for, what they have to smell like, what type of ingredients can be used. And so with that, the business was born.
What was your next step after that, after you realized that there was a real business opportunity here?
Yeah, I still took things pretty slowly. I was still a new mom, so my, obligations and time were spread pretty thin. But, just every week to week, I just was hearing from customers who were excited, and then I would get a little more excited. And I actually had some retailers approaching me at these markets too and asking if I was interested in selling my products in their stores. So that was, really validating and also really exciting to know that, I didn't have to work real hard to get those first couple of wholesale accounts. It kind of fell into my lap. So I said, why not? And so I had a lot to learn. I didn't know anything about selling wholesale. Of course, there's the pricing strategy that comes into play, the marketing piece and barcodes, right? I had no idea how to go out and get a barcode. So there was a lot of, quick research I had to do to make it all happen. But I was so excited that, it was fun.
Were you still producing your own products at home at this time, or did you work? Okay.
Yep. I was making on my stovetop. We had a really small home, about 700 to 800 square feet. And then when my baby was napping, I would just work. And so, most moms are sleeping while the baby naps, but I was just too excited to sleep. It was the only time I could work. And his bedroom was right off the kitchen. And so I had to kind of tiptoe around and be quiet. But yeah, with those early wholesale accounts too, I would bring my baby with me to drop off product because my husband was working during the day. And so I would go out on my little deliveries and carry him with me. And so it was fun because he's always been part of the business from day one.
When did the business turn into more than, just working out of the home and creating everything yourself? When did you realize you needed to bring on outside resources? And did you raise money for your company, or were you always bootstrapped?
I never raised. And I think partly because I did take it so slowly in those couple of years that there wasn't a lot of pressure to get a big sum of money. It was really like a day at a time, right? So I would embrace the opportunity that was right in front of me, continue to look for more opportunities to sell. But in those early days, I did have a lot of opportunity to kind of fall into my lap with these stores. But then I sort of got this itch to like, okay, I've expanded locally, like what more can I do? And that's when I really kind of kicked things into gear and started putting a little effort into some promotion. I had a lot of word of mouth from influencers. Like YouTube was huge back then, so people were talking about the product. So then I saw opportunity to build out a website too where customers could purchase. But I think, the real turning point was just the repeat customers, right? People coming back and wanting more and asking me for new fragrances and things and just where else can I find your product? And just the continuing, buildup of excitement.
When you were making this product on your own in your kitchen, how much were you able to produce each day? And how did you figure out the right formulas? That process to me sounds so like it might be so complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. But without having a whole, no business partners, no investors to answer to, I had room to fail, right? And start over and keep going until it felt perfect to me. As I mentioned, I'm not a chemist, I'm a scientist. And so it really was just, me sort of jumping in and experimenting. I want to step back a bit and talk about the bootstrapping piece again, because I think that's really important. And people ask all the time, how was I able to do that? And it was really recycling the profits back into the business, right? And just being really conscious of how you're spending your dollars. And so I wasn't, paying for these really fancy marketing campaigns. There was intention behind everything that I purchased. And yeah, that looked a little bit different as the business scaled, and we can get into that a little bit later. But I am a big proponent of growing, on your own terms and not bringing on capital if you don't need to. But back to your last question about formulating, that was a work in process over many years. And my formula continued to improve. I went to market with a product that I knew wasn't perfect. And I think that's the key for a lot of companies or a lot of founders is that we get so tied up, concerned my product's not, it's absolute best. I can't go to market yet, right? Until it's just 100% perfect. But what is perfect, right? Until you start talking to your customers, you don't really know what perfect means. And that'll change too. So I always encourage founders, if you're thinking about launching and your product is close and you feel like it's good enough, just get it out there and then it's going to evolve.
What were some of the biggest challenges early on in those first few years in business?
So many. I think, one was just learning. Like I didn't have a background in business. I actually had a business degree, which I got in college. So I had, a bit of knowledge, but no hands-on experience. And that's so different, right? You can get your education in business, but it doesn't arm you to be an entrepreneur. I didn't have any entrepreneurs in my family, So just learning, just even the terminology, right? That was being thrown at me sometimes. I'm like, I have no idea what that means. This was constantly Googling everything. And the cash piece, bootstrapping is not easy. You're constantly strapped for money. Hires, once I did start hiring, I think you asked earlier when I knew it was time to bring on an employee. And that was what I felt just so stretched thin that I, couldn't do anything more. And that's hard. That first hire, I think, was the hardest because I has had such control over everything. And giving that up to somebody new was not easy. So I hired a friend, actually, it was a friend of a friend. And so that helped a little bit, made me feel a little bit less pressure to be a certain kind of boss. And the two of us sort of grew together. And then from there, continuing to build the team was always really challenging.
What did that first hire do? What was it her? What was her role?
Yeah, it was a man. I brought
him in. Okay.
A man that helped with production. And so he was working in my studio. I had a little studio behind the house where I'd make the deodorant. So it was perfect. So he could go in there. He had privacy, play his music, and just make. And so, I was constantly in there doing quality control and working through issues. Production of natural products does pose a lot of issues when, there's temperature fluctuations, we're not using chemical stabilizers and things. And so we were often troubleshooting, problems with product. And so that was his job. And then I quickly after that hired another person to come in and he helped with shipping in my garage. And he was supposed to work less than 5 hours a week, but within a couple of weeks, he was basically full-time because the business really started to grow quickly.
I'm so fascinated by the product development process. So for anyone thinking about, going into their kitchen and trying to formulate something, and I know you did take that class, where do you go and get ingredients?
Yeah, so much Google, right? Google is my friend for sure. There are a lot of suppliers out there where you can, buy the basics, but really once you start producing in volume, that's when you have to dig a little deeper to really refine those relationships, make sure you're getting the best pricing, highest quality. But a lot of it's just research, some word of mouth. If you start meeting other entrepreneurs or makers, you're maybe getting some support from them. Where do you find your products? But, over time, too, you might outgrow your suppliers. So you might have one supplier that you've been depending on for a couple of years, but then all of a sudden your volumes, have increased. With Schmidt's, we started selling in retailers like Target, Costco, Walmart, right? So we had these huge volumes later, and your suppliers can't always keep up. And so then you're constantly looking for new ones. And that's a challenge. I always tell people to make sure you have more than one supplier because people, they'll run out of ingredients. And I've learned that the hard way where, we had shipments that were supposed to be delivered and didn't arrive on time. And then we were scrambling to find other suppliers. So that's certainly a takeaway for listeners is to have more than one supplier for all your ingredients.
How did you handle moments like that when it's, you go into this crisis mode and you're supposed to get this delivery and it doesn't come and they can't help you? How do you handle those moments?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels like the end of the world, right? That's a big problem, but you put things in perspective and do what you can do. And, generally customers are understanding if you are late on shipment, just being transparent. I know some companies would rather just go quiet and kind of wait, and then ship the order late. But I think, it's really important to just be upfront with your customers. Hey, we ran into this problem. Thank you for your patience. Your product will be there in a week. And here's a discount code to use on your next order.
Yeah, definitely agree. Being transparent with your customers and having conversations with them is so important. And that's how you build that loyalty and that connection. Right. So
I always say too, I think, a lot of founders, anytime there's an internal, operational glitch or setback, they freak out that, but realistically, the customers are only seeing from the outside, they don't see all the stresses and the setbacks and the challenges and crazy things that happen behind the scenes. So that's one thing I like to remind people too. If it might feel huge and heavy to you, but other people probably don't even notice, right?
Totally. They only see what they have access to be able to see, and not the behind the scenes of the inner workings, for sure. Jamie, I'd love to hear a little bit about the process of getting into these retailers, because I know a lot of our entrepreneuristas have created products and they are trying to figure out, how did they get into Target? How did they get into Walmart? What is that process like, and what should they expect?
Yeah, I made it sound easy for those first couple of retailers at the farmers markets that approached me, but after that, I really had to hustle to get into the account. So number one, you have to truly believe in your product and be persistent in knowing that it belongs in that store, right? So, for me, that looked like thinking about who my dream retailer was, and that in the beginning years, it was Whole Foods. And so I started thinking, okay, what stores might lead up to me getting into Whole Foods? And then that made me think of stores like, natural food co-ops. And so, it was really like kind of this laddering up process. So making a case for one store and then going one step beyond that, but always taking my sales numbers with me to prove, hey, I did great in this store, and now can I get a place on your store shelves? And, I know a lot of companies today are starting out D2C, like really strong internet sales, which sometimes allows them to sort of skip right to their dream retailer, because they have these really strong numbers from their website. And that's effective too. But for me, it took a bit before I really built out the website. And so mine, I depended a lot on retail, where it's okay, I'm successful in this store now. Will you take a chance on me? Brokers are really critical, especially for some of those bigger stores like Target. They often are the only ones that Target wants to talk to, right? Like, we only work through brokers, so find a broker and then we'll talk. But the way to connect with them is trade shows, specifically in the natural products industry. There's a trade show called Natural Products Expo. And anybody that's building in the space should definitely be going to that trade show. There's a lot of brokers, a lot of distributors, and you'll make connections with retailers there too.
What was the name of the trade show?
Natural Products Expo. They have a West and an East. There's one that's held in LA every year, and then one that's generally on the East Coast too. The LA one is huge.
Do regular consumers go to those trade shows just to
not
see products or no?
Shows. Those are specific for retailers and brokers and distributors. But I also did a ton of trade shows that were direct to the customer, like the farmer's market, but then also a lot of like craft shows and some of these like indie marketplaces. Schmidt's deodorant was a craft in the earliest years. And so I was able to have tables at like the craft shows next to people who were making clothing or jewelry or greeting cards. So that's fun too, to have that opportunity as a maker, right?
Any other tips you can share from the early days when you were at the farmers markets for our entrepreneuristas who have something that a product they want to test out to see if, the market's interested in it?
Yeah, I think just keep an open mind about who your customer is. I think for companies like natural deodorant, there was always this assumption that the customer was a certain type of person who shopped at a certain retailer or lived a certain type of lifestyle. But what really got me ahead, I think, was just knowing that anybody could be my customer. So if I saw, maybe an older man walking by the booth, right? Like, I would go after him just as much as I would the young mom with the kid in the stroller. Like, I think sometimes we close our mind to who our customer might be. And so always keep an open mind there.
What was your pitch when people would come up to the booth?
Yeah. Generally, I would just, they would look and say, oh, natural deodorant. And I would say, what kind of deodorant do you use? That would be the first question I'd ask him. It was funny. Oftentimes people didn't know. And I always saw that as a great opportunity, because if they didn't really have a brand that came to mind, like, ooh, they need one, that they can fall in love with. And it's funny because deodorant's not a sexy topic. And so some people would get uncomfortable. Other people would just spill their whole history of, deodorant usage and the problems they've had. And so, but I always encourage founders, just embrace those conversations and kind of follow the customer's lead, right? They'll talk as much as they want.
You know what's so interesting? I'm in a bunch of these mom Facebook groups, and I'm also into all of the natural products now. And similar to you, I became super interested in them actually when I was trying to get pregnant and realizing how important it is to know what you're putting on your body and in your body. But in all of these Facebook groups I'm in, I would say once a week, someone's posting like, what natural deodorant do you use? And like tons of responses. I see Schmidt's mentioned in there all the time. So I think, you started this so early, 10 plus years ago, but the market has definitely changed in the natural product industry, and people really are aware now. So it's awesome.
And it's funny, there's still huge opportunity. Schmidt's had come across a survey recently where it showed like less than 10% of people were using naturals. And so even though it's become a lot more mainstream, there's still a huge opportunity there. So there's a lot of education that comes with it. You know, some people are just skeptical. They hear natural and they assume it doesn't work. You know, there's sometimes the price points are higher, or again, there's this assumption that it's for a certain type of customer. So I like that it's become a lot more mainstream, but I also love that there's still opportunity to introduce more people.
Coming up, you'll hear why Jamie says lack of fear is a priceless advantage in starting your own business.
Hey, entrepreneuristas, it's Courtney. You know by now, I've become obsessed with how to make remote working the best it could possibly be. One problem that arose for me was what to wear when working from home. It's important to look professional on Zoom, but also feel comfortable in your own home. So I created Workrobe. Workrobe is a reinvention of the robe. Our robes mean business, and no one on Zoom will ever know you're wearing a robe. It looks like a professional shirt on the top. Let's keep that our little secret. I created a special offer just for you. Head over to myworkrobe.com for 15% off your first order using code Entrepreneurista15. That's myworkrobe.com, code Entrepreneurista15 for 15% off your first order. The only reason you'll be asking, is this meeting being recorded? Is because it should be.
So you started in 2010 in your kitchen. At what year did you take the production outside of your kitchen? And was there a particular order that resulted in you having to find new methods of manufacturing?
I moved manufacturing spaces 4 times over 3 years. And, as you know, it started in my tiny little kitchen. And I maxed that out as long as I could. You know, we had boxes of deodorant pile up in, you know, every corner of the house. And then it got to a point where, all right, if we're going to continue doing this, you know, it makes sense to look outside the house. And I was fortunate that there was a space nearby my home that was up for lease. There was just this random building. There was a pet shop in the building. There was a paper shredder next door. And then there was this tiny little space that could be used for anything. And so I thought, ooh, that could be my production space. And so that was in, about 3 years into the business. And I took my two employees that had been working at my house, and you know, they came over there with me. And then from there, things really started to take off. I also had a feature on TV around that time on Fox. And that resulted in a lot of website orders, and things then just kind of picked up and never slowed down. But it was good timing because I had the bigger space. So I was able to start to build out my team a little bit more. But, you know, being bootstrapped, you can't just hire a bunch of people at once. And so I, you know, would start somebody part-time and sort of increase their hours. And I think that's one of the trickiest parts of running a bootstrap business is paying your employees and, you know, knowing when to make them full-time versus part-time, because you want the help, right? But it's like, what can you afford? And it's the balancing act constantly. But we were in that space about a year and a half, and had expanded once while we were in there. I had to add on another little extra room. But let's see, about a year and a half after that, we ended up getting a bigger space, a little more legit, about 10,000 square feet. And that was in like a real established business park. So moving into that was definitely like sort of the next phase of the business. That it was really exciting because I remember buying the conference table and, you know, all the things that come along with it, and sort of like, wow, I'm like playing house here, right? And like building this factory. And but the machinery, I think, was the biggest challenge. Like, because, you know, I in the other space, I was able to increase my pot size, and we had this little hand crank labeler, and things were still pretty small. But once I moved into the bigger space, I had opportunity to upgrade my equipment too. So that meant doing a lot of research into what types of machines I would need. And, you know, at that point, I really had a choice. I could have moved to contract manufacturers, right? Or make this investment in these machines and just keep building in-house. But I couldn't imagine giving up the production. It was something that was so personal to me. You know, I'd started in my kitchen. So I was so close to the product. And so passing it off to another manufacturer just didn't feel right. So I made that choice to sort of wing it and grow the factory. And, you know, as we continued to grow, that meant continuing to upgrade machines and knowing how much space we needed. I think that was the most challenging part, was predicting how much space you need and how much inventory you want to keep on hand versus, you know, how much you want to produce per demand. And so that's probably a whole podcast in itself.
I'm sure. We'll have to do a follow-up on manufacturing.
Yeah, I go deep into it in my book, the kind of from maker to manufacturer, that whole journey, what that entails and all the challenges that come along with that.
Did you ever have a business plan, or did you ever put one together once you started?
I never had a, you know, an official plan written out, especially in the earliest years. It was really just sort of embracing the opportunity that was right in front of me. But as the business, you know, got more sophisticated, I had to put some planning into it. But still, I was never looking really far ahead. I think that probably could have thrown me off a little bit. It's very overwhelming to think about like what your end goal is. And so it was more like, okay, what are my goals for this week? You know, maybe in a month. And then having this bigger vision, right? Like I mentioned, dream retailers. And once I had gotten that Whole Foods account, my dream retailer then became Target, right? So having these big sort of goals and visions, but not like a real concrete plan on how to get there.
Did you know that you ultimately wanted to get acquired or have a partner?
No, that was never in my thinking. We had been approached a few times by little companies just sending letters in the mail like, oh, I'd love to acquire your business. And I just throw them in the garbage, right? And didn't think much of it. But once Schmidt's really hit mass market, Target, Costco, Walmart, we became pretty strapped for cash. And that was the point where I was like, okay, we either need to raise capital or bring on, you know, a bigger partner that has these resources because we can't keep bootstrapping this. I had taken out one line of credit along the way, actually two, that were helpful in you know, producing some of that inventory up front. But once we really hit those shelves, it was time to make a decision. So throughout that process of starting to entertain conversations with VCs and hedge funds, we had the interest from Unilever, and then a couple other big strategics entered the picture, and they were interested in the acquisition as well. So throughout the growth of the business, it was never my thinking. But once we hit that point of, you know, really being strapped for cash, I realized not just the potential in getting the money, but having the support and resources of a big conglomerate like Unilever could do a lot for the company.
What was the process like having conversations with Unilever and other funds? Did you have someone you could go to for advice to figure out this process? Because I know it can definitely be very intense.
Yeah, we had a broker, actually Goldman Sachs was involved. And so they were great because they were the middle person who was able to, you know, negotiate things for us, explain things, tell us, you know, what they needed. And so we had, you know, tons of phone calls with Unilever throughout the process, but it was nice to have sort of the middleman there, you know, helping coordinate things.
At the time that you sold, how many employees did you have?
We had around 150. And that was mostly in our manufacturing across two shifts we had at that point. Unilever did not purchase the manufacturing piece of Schmidt's, so they kept the brand team, the marketing, you know, and everything else. But we ended up outsourcing the production. The timing of that worked well because I actually had taken on a co-packer about a year before the acquisition as backup. You know, we couldn't meet all the demand in-house. And I also started thinking, you know, how sustainable is this long-term? And what if, you know, something terrible happens to my factory, like what can we do? So I had made preparations to, you know, eventually, you know, transition that manufacturing. But you know, the great thing about keeping that manufacturing in-house was that you had so much control over things like limited edition offerings. And once you start working with an outside co-packer, you know, you lose that flexibility that you have as, you know, as a startup.
Can you share a little bit about the learning lessons from, you know, after the sale? You've now gone from being a solo founder to now being part of this big company that we all know, Unilever, and giving up control. What is that like, and lessons that you learned from that?
I think the first thing I learned was that as a startup, you move very quickly. But once you join a family like Unilever, you know, things slow down. So that took a little bit of getting used to. You know, there's a lot of processes and procedures in place and new expectations that, you just didn't have when you were growing quickly as a startup. But it's all for the better. You know, I think having them more control in the systems ends up being beneficial for the company long term. But it's certainly an adjustment period.
How did your role change once you did get acquired?
When we started talking to Unilever, you know, it was important for me that I stay involved in the brand. You know, that was a non-negotiable. But I, you know, there were options for what that could look like. Could I stay on in operations or leading the company? Did I want to sort of step back from operations and become more of a spokesperson? And so we came to an agreement that felt good for both sides. And so I'm still very tied to the brand, but I'm not in the day-to-day headache, the operations. And so it's been, gosh, like 4 years now since the acquisition, still working with the brand, mostly advising on some of the product development, supporting their international expansion, And it's just really cool to see the brand continue to thrive. There's some really great leadership on the team now. And yeah, I'm super happy to stay involved.
And I know you've now gone on to start your own fund, but love to hear about why you decided to start it and what it's been like.
Yeah, it's not something that I had put a lot of thought into when I was growing Schmitz, right? I never thought, oh, someday I'm going to have an investment fund. But after the acquisition, I was approached by a lot of founders who were looking for advice on things. And I started to realize that, you know, I had a lot to teach and a lot to offer, not just in terms of advice, but also in capital. So my husband, Chris, and I decided to start the fund. Chris was there alongside me growing Schmitz. And also together, we had gained a lot of operational experience that could be valuable to these brands that we're investing in. So we started Color. And our goal was to, initially we set out to really offer financial support to underrepresented entrepreneurs. We just felt like there was so much opportunity there that was being overlooked. And as the fund continued to grow, that mission, you know, stayed at the forefront, but became much easier because we had been surrounding ourselves by people that didn't look like us for so many years. And so now that deal flow just comes naturally, which is really cool. I know a lot of funds have to work really hard to put diversity at the forefront of, you know, their deal flow, but for us, it's just naturally there. And so that's been really fun. We've invested in close to 25 companies now, and all in consumer products. And that's where our passion is, and that's where we can have the most impact. We look for companies that want to really build out their distribution, kind of like Schmitz did. So we call it omni-channel, right? When you have retail distribution across different channels. So it's your website, it's a mass market, it's some smaller stores and international. So that we're able to really plug in there and help some of these brands grow their distribution.
What are some of the brands that you're excited about that you've invested in?
Yeah, there's a lot. House, have you heard of House? It's a spirits brand, low alcohol beverage, really cool branding. We actually have invested in quite a number of beverage companies. It's really trending right now across, you know, sparkling waters and alcohol and some of these more functional beverages. So Recess is another one that has a really cool magnesium product that they launched recently. Pop Shop Live is one of my favorites. It's a live streaming platform where founders can share their products through this feed. It's a great way to be discovered. So if people have a product they want to get out there, definitely check out Pop Shop Live.
I'm looking it up here. So cool. No, that's good. That's awesome. Yeah. Very
you
cool.
You also started Supermaker. I would love to know more about that.
We also started a platform called Supermaker. This was really active during COVID. It was a great way to bring founders, you know, just a place to come together and find resources to support them through things that were happening around COVID, like building a brand during a crazy pandemic. And so we put out a lot of content, articles and things to help founders build. We also created a grant program through Supermaker, where we awarded two founders a grant of $50,000 to build their businesses during COVID. And then through that, we also built out this really strong mentor network. So we had mentors like Mark Cuban, Rebecca Minkoff joining on to support some of the founders that we were working with as well. And I launched a book also by the name of Supermaker. And that book tells my story of growing Schmitz from the kitchen up to the acquisition by Unilever with tangible takeaway advice. So my goal in writing it was really to, you know, not just tell the story of Schmitz, but to tell it in a way that people could learn from all my setbacks and mistakes and wins, and just really just candidly telling my story. I really, you know, I think there's opportunity for anybody to become an entrepreneur. And I think with a story like mine is just like the perfect example of that. If you just have a product you believe in and a passion and commitment to making it happen, like anybody can do it. So that was my goal in writing the book, was to inspire people to understand that potential in themselves.
I love that. What was the process like writing the book? How long did it take?
Yeah, it was fun to, I think the best part of it was just going back to those early years and kind of reliving the experience, and also just seeing how much I had grown, you know, as an individual, as an entrepreneur. The process took about a year and a half, a lot of digging into emails and then remembering, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, turning all that into a book. When I first started, I asked myself, do I really have enough content to share? But then as the story started to come together, I had so much. And so it was a fun process for sure.
Well, we're definitely going to have to read your book. And for all of our listeners, we will link out to your book in our show notes. So it'll be easy for everyone to find. What do you know now that you wish you knew when you had first started your business?
I'm asked that question a lot. And it's funny. I always say, I don't think anything. I think the naivety that I had, you know, just the sort of being oblivious to things and just kind of just being excited was an asset. I think sort of the less that you know, the better equipped you are sometimes, because knowing how much I know now, I think I would be scared in some way. You know, it's important to know what you're getting into in building business, but to really obsess over like knowing every detail, I think can just be an obstacle in a lot of ways. Trust your intuition. I've leaned on that so much in growing my business. And I think that's still very important for founders. I think it's a mix of your intuition and then just really listening to your customers. I think that was just my secret to success.
For our founders who are thinking about raising capital or currently raising capital, especially right now where so many things are being done remotely, any tips for how they can reach out to you? Best tips for pitching? What do you look for?
Yeah, I'm always available. I love to hear from people through DMs on Twitter or Instagram. You can also reach out to Color, my fund, at hello@color.capital. Tips for pitching. I always tell people, don't obsess too much over having a really lengthy deck. You know, just really hit the most important points. What problem are you solving? Why are you the best person to solve the problem? What does your team look like? Maybe you don't have a team, and that's okay too. I encourage people also to not get too hung up on credentials. I think a lot of times as new founders, we feel this need to really prove that we're qualified to be entrepreneurs, right? So we pull these things out of our past and try to present ourselves in a way, you know, to make us look qualified. But really, for me as an investor and just based on my own experience, it's more about just the passion for the product and the belief behind the business and just showing that you know the category. You know, I think that's really key for me is like, if you're playing in the food space, for example, let's say you're making crackers, just really knowing who your competition is, where your opportunity is, and you know how you can excel in that category, I think that's the key.
Up next, why Jamie's known for the quote, "Say yes now, then figure out how." How many times have you yelled at the computer screen, "You're on mute," during a video call, and an extremely important point you were trying to make gets completely lost and people move on? If you're anything like me, this is probably one of the many frustrating aspects of video calls and meetings that make them less productive than they could be. At Socialfly, we have fixed this problem and now we're sharing the solution with you. Now you can get virtual meeting digicards. Each pack of digicards includes 20 color-coded professional cards that not only streamline communication during meetings, but also makes each video call or meeting an opportunity to collaborate and have more fun. No more waving your arms, being ignored, or frantically typing in the chat. Simply hold up the printed card with the right message for everyone to clearly see. From letting a team member know that they're on mute or frozen, sharing positive feedback, to ensuring meetings end on time, DigiCards cover all situations you may encounter on your video calls. We've been using DigiCards at Socialfly, and they have completely transformed our video meetings. Ready to test this out for your team and bring the fun and engagement back into your video meetings? Go to hellodigicards.com. That's HELLODIGICARDS.com to place your first order and use code ENTREPRENISTA10 for 10% off. That's hellodigicards.com and code ENTREPRENISTA10 for 10% off your first order. Get ready to take your virtual team meetings to the next level. All right, Jamie, we're going to do a fun little segment we've been doing, some rapid fire questions. So we're going to ask you a question. The first thing that comes to your mind, like one or two words. Are you ready?
Yep.
Actually, this one's three words. Describe yourself in three words.
Relatable, humble, committed.
If you could learn one new skill, what would it be?
I want to perfect my tennis skills.
Me too.
I already play, but I want to be like a pro. So I'm putting more energy into that.
And we're going to have to connect you to Jen on our Entrepreneurista team. She is a tennis pro. That's her thing. Right. So when you're in New York, you guys can meet up. She'll give you a lesson. What is your most used emoji when you send a text?
The upside down smiley face.
I actually just started using that one.
What does that mean? Can someone tell me what that means?
For me, it's like something feels like a little bit goofy or like I'm making fun of myself. Or, right? Yeah, it's hard to describe, but I feel like it's very fitting for a lot of
things that I have. I love that.
What is the app on your phone that you can't live without?
Probably TikTok right now.
Interesting.
Are you looking for like a functional app?
No. That's my next question, actually. What is your favorite tech tool or business solution that's helped you?
You guys, I'm a big nerd with keeping notes, but handwritten notes or the notes app on my phone. I don't have like, and I'm open to ideas. Sometimes I feel like it's this late in my life. Why start now? But like people have organizational tools they want to share. But for me, it's literally the notes app on my phone and handwritten notes. Got my entrepreneur's notebook here.
Yay! Oh, good. You got it.
A lot of times when I do podcasts, I'm inspired by things. I'm like, oh, I should talk about that more than I'll write it down. Thank you.
Well, when you finish all those papers, let me know. We'll send you more.
All right.
Do you have a hidden talent?
Oh my gosh. I want to say it's like singing. I'm constantly making up songs and driving my family crazy, but I don't know if it's a talent, but it's a hidden sort of desire to express myself.
I love that. I grew up doing musical theater, so I'm big into singing. Yes. Oh. All right, our final rapid fire question. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Time travel, I think. Yeah.
Do you want to go back in time or go ahead?
I think I would go back. I'm afraid to go forward.
Oh, I hear you on that one. Well, Jamie, I'd love to hear about your new TV adventure that you were just telling us about. How did that happen and what is it about?
Yeah, I'll be on this show called Going Public. It's going to stream on Entrepreneur Media and it comes out later this fall. It's a show that follows founders as they're raising capital and they're raising through Regulation A+. For people who don't know what that is, basically viewers can invest while they watch from their couch. So you don't have to be an accredited investor. Anybody who's 18 and older in the US can invest. So it's super cool. It's a great opportunity for brands to gain exposure. It's leveling the playing field for investors who otherwise don't have opportunity to invest in some of these companies. And my role on the show is to be a mentor. So I'm going to help some of these brands as they scale their companies. And there's 5 brands that are currently scheduled to be featured and they're all really cool and very different. So I'm excited. I've learned a lot just through the process of working with these founders.
That's so, so exciting. You have a lot of exciting projects that you're working on. What does a typical day look like for you?
Waking up, having my coffee outside, try to get a workout in before anything else gets my attention. Every day looks a little different, but generally there's a call with a potential brand that I might invest in, or maybe a brand I'm already invested in, some press, like podcasts like this. My son has been home for the summer and also throughout COVID. So he's become a very prominent part of my everyday. It'll be weird when he goes back to school. he's 11. So the two of us are our buddies and try to make time together. And, my husband and I do everything together too. So 3 of us, happy little family working from home. We recently moved down to San Diego from Portland. And so still learning the city here and enjoying the nice weather and swimming and playing tennis.
Definitely have the best weather in San Diego. Yeah, that's for sure. When did you move there?
February.
Oh, very recent move.
Yeah, very recently.
Courtney and I both moved. We did a kind of a pandemic move too. We're both down in Florida now. We moved from New York to Florida.
Oh, wow. That's a big move.
Oh, yeah. We made the move as well.
Are you in Miami?
I'm in Miami.
Okay. Yeah. There's a whole movement to Miami.
I actually think I started the movement. No.
Probably did.
I moved here in June and then like 3 months later, everyone else moved here. So
yeah, Courtney and I moved down June 1st of 2020. So we were early adopters. I'm a little bit north in Palm Beach Gardens, but yeah, I've been running everything remotely now. That's just the way of the world for many, many businesses. What would you say you're most grateful for every day?
Oh boy. I think just everybody who helped me get where I am today, growing Schmidt's. There were so many employees and even retailers and just all the customers, just everybody who helped contribute to my success. I wouldn't be here without thousands of people.
Any other tips you can share on how you manage everything now, multiple businesses, managing obviously family as well. How do you do it all? What are your secrets?
Yeah. I think most important is just cutting myself slack. It's hard for people to do, right? We have these such high standards for ourselves. And I think we just need to understand that, like, maybe there's a day that kind of goes wasted, or, you know, maybe we don't have to check off every single thing on our list this week. And so it's just cutting myself slack has been just really key for me growing the business and now today and all the other projects that I have.
Is there a favorite mantra or quote that defines your work ethic?
I've been known for the quote, say yes now, then figure out how. I go deep into that in my book. And basically, it's just about embracing every opportunity and, you know, not letting fear get in the way. I do think it's also healthy to know when to say no. But my idea there is more if you're saying no because you're afraid of it, like I challenge that. Say yes, you'll fail at a handful of things, but you'll likely come out ahead.
Was there anything that you said yes to that you regretted later or really learned from because you maybe made a mistake?
There were some opportunities in business that I probably wasn't ready for right away. And I was, you know, excited to say yes. And then I would be scrambling to try to, you know, make enough product to meet the need. And things like sampling boxes, right? Like there's subscription boxes where I would donate, you know, 100,000 sticks of deodorant because it seemed like a really cool opportunity. But then I'm like, oh, wow, this is distracting from other things. And, you know, ultimately it pays off, right? Because the customers get to try the product and turn into repeat customers and things. But and then there's, you know, some probably relationship things. I had a business partner that some regrets there, but that's again a story for another podcast.
Yeah. Well, my final question for you, Jamie, is what does being an entrepreneurista mean to you?
I think just being unwilling to settle, just continuing to believe in yourself and knowing when to block out the noise and trusting yourself.
So important. Definitely trusting yourself is the key. Well, Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your story and journey with us and all of our listeners. It's so inspiring what you have been able to accomplish. And I know what a journey it's been. So it's really incredible. So thank you so much for being here. Where can everyone find you and follow you and buy your book? And then for those who are interested in reaching out to you, if they're raising money, what's the best way to reach out?
I'm on all socials, so LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and it's just Jamie Schmidt, J-A-I-M-E. For email, hello@color.capital is great. If you want to send a deck, we'll definitely get that. And my book is available everywhere books are sold. So Amazon, all the indie bookstores, the bigger bookstores. If anybody reads it, and reach out, let me know, and I'd love to hear your feedback.
Amazing. And we'll be posting all of those links in our show notes so you guys can all check it out. Jamie, thank you again for being here. I'm Stephanie.
And I'm Courtney.
And this is the best business meeting we've ever had. Hey, thanks for listening and leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'd love to stay in touch with each of you. You can listen to all of our latest episodes at entrepreneurista.com. and connect with us on Instagram @entrepreneuristas. We'd also love to invite you to join the Entrepreneurista League, our private membership community for trailblazing women. You can head over to entrepreneurista.com/the-league. We'll see you there. Wishing you a productive week ahead.